This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 286 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Good evening from downtown Chicago, where it's bristly and cold and chilly and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, you've been having more than enough of that kind of stuff.
We've had three winters worth of winter.
Yeah, we're all shivering. Also joining us is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. It's probably cold there too, David.
We're not supposed to talk about the weather.
Okay, strike that. So how are things in Philly?
Things are fine. Looking forward to a good show tonight. We've got lots to talk about.
All right, for sure. Our guest this episode is Jason Rabinowitz. Now, Jason, you'll recall, has been on the show a couple of times in the past. Jason's certainly an av geek and a freelance journalist. He writes aviation for a variety of different places, but he's been doing some work over at airchive.com, roothappy.com, the flight search and data site. You can also find him from time to time at David Parker Brown's Airline Reporter. And I've even caught Jason doing some work over at the Runway Girl Network. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hello, happy to be here. I know we're not allowed to talk about the weather, but I just have two words, polar vortex.
Yeah, that's a dirty word. We have to change the iTunes rating when we start throwing in words like that these days. But Jason, it's great to have you back, and we look forward to having some great conversations with you on a variety of topics.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Now, we're going to start off, as always, with a little bit of the aviation news from the past week. And then after that, we'll speak with Jason. We have a few things that we thought might be kind of interesting to chat about. And then David, an aviation history segment. What do we have coming up?
I'm invoking rule number one when it comes to the history segment.
We get a lot of that lately, I think.
There's a reason why it's my segment, and I'll write what I want to. And I thought we'd have a visit with Susie and go back to visit Susie the Cirrus.
Now, we talked about Susie the Cirrus once before, didn't we? That sounds familiar.
Yeah, she was around for Christmas. Now she's around for another holiday and another little flight with her favorite pilot, Pilot Rob.
Okay, great. That should be exciting. We also have an Australia Desk report. The Boys Down Under talk with Matt Hall about his preparations for the upcoming Red Bull Air Race season. That's back on. And then in his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson talks to Christoph, the editor-in-chief of Info Lotnicz. And so we'll look forward to a little bit of Polish aviation news. And then we'll close out with just a little bit of the listener mail we received in the last week. All right, I think we better get started. Is everyone ready?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Ready.
Well, we see an article from AIN Online. FAA likely to miss deadlines on next-gen UAS PBN. The FAA is kind of getting a little bit behind some of the requirements that are placed on them. Some of these from the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012. This act really covers a lot of territory. Next gen unmanned vehicles, drones, or UASs, as the FAA calls them. And there really are quite a few requirements. You know, guy, I thought it was interesting. I started to read part of this act of 2012, And one thing that struck me was just the degree to which the U.S. Congress dictates what the FAA does, when they do it, how they do it, and that sort of thing. But I don't know. I guess, Rob, that's probably nothing new.
Well, I think this story between you and me is a bit of a yawn. And it's not because Paul Lau wrote it. I know, Paul. But I'm just saying that in terms of listening to people complain about the FAA not being up to the task of, and then fill in the blank. I mean, we've been listening to this for a long time. So what they do is that they get someone behind them to really shove them into getting things done. And who do they grab? The Congress, who has an incredible record of getting things done. So now, don't we have the blind leading the blind or shoving the blind or something?
It kind of seems that way. It does. It really does. Next gen, yeah, we've been talking about that for ages.
Ever.
Exactly, Jason. And, you know, there are the time frames that the U.S. Congress has sort of mandated for the FAA. And it looks like they're not going to hit them. Dave and I certainly have talked about the FAA requirements to have unmanned aerial systems integrated into the national airspace by 2014. And David, we don't see that happening by that date either, do we?
Well, it is February. They might make it if, I mean, let's face it, on the East Coast here and basically almost all of North America, hell is freezing over, so you never know. They might make that goal.
That's a good point. But, you know, I guess, too, think about it. What to the people at FAA, I mean, if they make it, they don't make it, what's the motivation? I don't think that most of us out in the real world that have to work for a living feel sometimes as if folks at the FAA have much motivation, much get up and go, much of a sense of urgency. Ah, so they miss it by a year or two or so. But everybody that uses the system that has to pay for this stuff, they're really upset. And again, what are we going to do? Sure. We're going to go to Congress? I mean, you haven't heard Congress say anything about this Reform Act or Reauthorization Act since it has been signed, essentially, except to pat themselves on the back when something gets signed. So I don't know. And look at the reports that have come out. The Inspector General from the Department of Transportation has been beating on FAA. The GAO has been beating on FAA. And this one, I think, what was this from? Was this a GAO report that we were talking about? Oh, this was the IG from the Department of Transportation. Yeah. So, I mean, okay, so if you go back and look at the IG or the GAO and look at the number of reports they have written over the last, I'll bet just the last 2 years, that say FAA doesn't have its act together and fill in the blank, there are a lot of them. There've got to be a dozen of them. And my point, I guess, is so what? I mean, it's nice to know, but what does it take to get them moving?
What's the consequence if they don't? I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen is that they get hauled up in front of Congress for a hearing, and that's uncomfortable, and you have to try to explain the situation. But, I mean, that's kind of it, isn't it?
Well, that's true. At least that's what it looks like to me. I mean, even if they haul up the FAA administrator, what's he going to say? He doesn't really have that much experience in terms of these topics anyway, so he's only going to say whatever it is someone that works for him tells him to say. So it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, I think.
It's a shame, too. It's something they've really been pushing for a long time. I mean, I was in DFW a couple months ago, and at one of the boarding gates, they have this whole big kiosk of next gen coming to DFW soon, and it outlays all the wonderful, magnificent things that next gen's going to bring. And it's probably been there since 2012, and who knows when this actually happens.
And they just never plugged it in.
No, I think somebody unplugged it to charge their iPad.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, and there are companies and organizations that have to expend money, resources, time, effort into things like NextGen, as well as some of the other things that are in this act. And, I mean, if you're doing that, you can't rely, and you can't rely on the FAA or whoever for the thing to move forward, how can you plan for that? How can you plan your expenditures? How can you develop a business case for something that's got such great uncertainty? So I think that's kind of a factor.
It's even down to the airlines. The article mentions ADS-B, that most people aren't going to meet that. And I know the FAA helped JetBlue to offset some of the cost of installing ADS-B. And a couple of years down the road, they basically turned back and said, we really don't see the benefits from this. They installed it on, I think, 30, 36 planes, and they just never took it a step further from them. They just did not see the benefit from installing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I was browsing through this act, there was one thing that caught my eye. It was section 403, musical instruments. And I'm thinking, what is that all about?
Is someone breaking guitars again?
Well, listen to this. Part one, small instruments as carry-on baggage. The act says, an air carrier providing air transportation shall permit a passenger to carry a violin, guitar, or other musical instrument in the aircraft cabin without charging the passenger a fee, in addition to any standard fee that carrier may require for comparable carry-on baggage, if, and then there's a couple of conditions. One is it either has to go underneath the seat or in the overhead bin, basically, and there has to be time available for the passenger to stow that musical instrument. Yeah, I read that, and the first thing I thought about was breaking guitars.
Okay. This is in the same next-gen bill that we're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. It's it really covers a lot of territory. And it makes kind of an interesting read, actually. We'll put a link to this act in the show notes. If you're interested, you might want to just sort of breeze through it and take a look, because the scope, the breadth, and sometimes the depth, but mostly the breadth of scope of this thing is quite quite interesting.
Boy, that segues well into the next thing. Breadth and scope.
That's right.
I think that would be appropriate for what happened on the next story. Huh, Rob?
This far out, man.
Yeah, this is an item that's been in the news. And in fact, Rob wrote a piece for CNN on the topic. Bieber and the charter flight and the drugs and alcohol and whatever else they were doing on board. Well, it was so out of control that the flight attendant had to seek refuge away from the passengers, and the pilots had to don oxygen masks because the marijuana smoke, allegedly, was so great that they feared that they could be impaired by what the passengers on this charter flight were doing. Just incredible. And Rob, I love reading the comments on the CNN piece or under the CNN piece you submitted.
They were better than the story, I have to tell you. They really were.
Yeah, people
were
really
some funny things.
Ripped into Bieber.
Yeah, and
reading the comments is just a dangerous thing on the internet these days.
Uh-huh. Well, and of course the CNN people kind of brought it on themselves because they changed the title I gave it and said, is Justin Bieber out of control? And of course, you know, the first comments were, hello, what makes you think, you know, where have you been? But it was an interesting point that, you know, this was a charter airplane. It was a Gulfstream that was chartered from an outfit at Teterboro. And they flew up to, let's see, where did they go? They flew up to somewhere in Canada. I forgot the exact airport to get the Bieb and the Bieb boy bunch, brought him back, and I guess the dope and the booze were flowing pretty heavily, and it started off with them being pretty abusive to the flight attendant. It was a fairly short flight too. I believe it was under an hour. So again, I'm not quite sure where they came from headed back into Teterboro, but the real concern was that once the cabin started to fill up with smoke, even though it's recirculated, you still got a lot of dope flying around in the cabin there, and the two guys up front put their masks on just in case. And of course, the point I made was that beside the fact that most of the charter pilots that I know would have never put up with this, even if it was the Bieb, I can't believe that the FAA just gave them a slap on the hand and said, basically, don't do that again. Because when they did get to Teterboro, the Customs and Border Patrol folks at Teterboro are known to be very, very nice until something tips them off, and then they can just be really aggressive. So when we would go in there coming back from somewhere overseas, we'd always be very nice to them because they could really slow you down. And apparently they got inside the cabin and the smoke was so heavy that everybody went, whoa, you know, but they couldn't find anything. So they let them go. And I guess everybody thought it was interference with the flight crew, but the feds just, nobody seems to have pressed it. Although I did hear some comments that they were thinking about it. But seriously, I mean, I guess what concerned me is that you have a bunch of guys in the back being crazy, smoking dope, what have you. And if the guys in the front hadn't been sharp enough to put on their masks to try to breathe pure oxygen, and they'd tried to fly with that stuff floating around the cabin, they could have been impaired too. And you don't really realize it's happening until you're already under. And coming into some of the busiest airspace in the world, a couple of guys that are high, I mean, this is crazy. But, you know, there's always going to be some company that's going to carry the Beeb because even if they say, well, the price is triple now, they'll say, okay, fine, we'll triple the price and we'll pay it and we'll go. And it's, of course, this, for the listeners who are not in the United States, is what, 3 weeks after the Beeb was arrested down in Miami for drag racing on some side streets in his Lamborghini. So he's a bit of a kid with too much money and no adult supervision.
But Rob, he was flying home from his arraignment in Toronto.
With his father.
With his father.
Wait, this was the arraignment for the drag racing?
No, this was the arraignment for knocking over a limo driver in Toronto.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
You got to keep better track of your Bieber arraignments.
Yeah, it can be hard.
I mean, come on. And then, of course, there obviously was no adult supervision on this flight, even though his father was with him. So that it sounds like Lindsay Lohan all over again. It sounds like who else? Chris Brown. It sounds like, I don't know, all these people get more money than sense and we let them get away with it. But I'm sorry. I guess I'm sounding my age, but it just ain't right.
But why didn't they just land? Between Teterboro and YYZ, which is Toronto.
Oh, yeah, they were in Toronto then. Okay.
There's a gazillion airports between there and Teterboro that they could just have landed at and thrown them off the airplane. I guess I don't know why they insisted on proceeding with the flight.
Well, my guess is that when they took off and you climb to altitude, I mean, it takes 20, 30 miles, 40 miles to get to altitude. And if you're 40 miles, 50 miles downrange from Toronto headed to New York, you're almost approaching the first point on an arrival into New York. And then they're level and they're saying, oh, gee, what's going on? What do we do? We have to think about this. And by that time, they're closer and closer. And my guess is that they didn't want to put down in another Canadian airport. So they probably ended up continuing it on into New York. But there was a big discussion on the NBAA boards about this, and most of the people that I was reading were saying the same thing, that at very worst they'd have had the cops meet them at the airplane. But then these charter guys are thinking if they do that, they're going to lose their job because their boss is going to say, are you crazy?
Well, when it comes to passenger behavior on a charter flight, I mean, there's a couple of issues. One might be what's illegal to do, and another could be what are behaviors that affect flight safety. So if we just stick with flight safety for a minute, how is that determined? Is that an issue up to the pilots to decide?
Well, sure, yeah, absolutely it is. And the one difference, of course, between a charter airplane or a business aviation airplane and an airliner is that the doors on the charter airplanes are normally not constructed the same way that a secure cockpit door is on an airliner. In fact, most of the I don't think I ever flew a business jet that had a door that closed. So it's a different kind of a relationship, and that was part of what my point was to the CNN folks is, you know, if that'd been the moment as they're on the arrival somewhere, that one of these yahoos wanders up to the cockpit and happens to distract somebody from a radio call or seeing an airplane or something, this could have been much worse. Now, I grant you, as someone said, oh, they've been doing this for years, all the rock groups do this, and you're right, it doesn't make it right, but it is what it is. We know about this one.
If something like that were to occur, and the pilots, the captain, sort of declared that there was a flight safety issue, who backs the pilot up? I mean, is it the employer, or is it the FAA, or is the pilot kind of left on his own if the passenger of the charter flight says, no, that's not the way it was, I'm being, mischaracterized and that sort of thing. Who backs up the pilot? Anybody?
Well, usually it would have to be the company. It would have to be the company. I mean, and in this sense, this was a charter flight. So if the company, the owner or the director of flight ops did not want to back the pilots up, that would be a problem. And that, if that were known ahead of time that the company was not terribly supportive of its employees, that could have made these folks somewhat reluctant to take a stand. Except the flight attendant did say, "I'm never going to fly when these guys are on board again." But again, that takes, my guess is that she was probably not a full-time employee. Most of the flight attendants tend to be contract ladies or contract people. But again, if the company did not back the pilot up, they'd probably be looking for another job.
All right. Well, we have an item here where someone else has been ruffling some feathers lately. And this is U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. And he said that if a blindfolded person was taken to Hong Kong's airport and asked where they were, they would say, "This must be America. It's a modern airport." But Biden goes on, "But if a blindfolded person were taken to LaGuardia Airport in New York, they would say, I must be in some third world country." So that's really caused some people to take notice. How bad is LaGuardia? Do we think that's kind of an accurate characterization?
It may have been poor wording, but what he's saying, it definitely rings true that LaGuardia is decrepit, really. It's an ancient building, ancient facilities. Everything about it is old, at least in the central terminal building. But maybe he could have worded it a little bit differently, but what he's saying is absolutely true, that our airports in the United States really have fallen behind, and we don't seem to be catching up at any rate that would really get us there.
Now, isn't there a plan to do some upgrades at LaGuardia?
There is. The central terminal building, which dates back to, I think, the mid-60s, has been slated to be completely torn down and a new building put up in its place for probably the last decade. But the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey has been so busy with the World Trade Center project that they have basically swept everything else under the rug for the last decade as that building has gone up. But the Port Authority just issued their master plan for the next decade, and they are going to be spending a ton of money on LaGuardia and Newark as well. But improvements are coming, but it's prodding like this that really makes the Port Authority, I guess, realize that they have a lot of work to do.
Mm. And I would suspect that any kind of significant airport upgrade is going to cost a lot of money and take a lot of time. And that's a little problematic, especially if the economy is not rolling ahead with some gusto.
It is billions and billions of dollars that they're spending, especially at LaGuardia. And it's going to take a long time. They have to completely tear down the building that's currently there, two old hangars that are there, and then build over the place that they just demolished, but somehow not interrupt ongoing flight operations. So it's going to be quite an operation, but thankfully Terminal C and D that Delta currently occupies, as well as US Air and I think WestJet, Delta's done a nice job with that along with OTG. They have iPads everywhere, and it's really quite nice in C and D, but the central terminal building where most of the airlines are, it's going to be completely knocked down and started over from scratch.
Well, let me play devil's advocate a little bit and pose this question to you guys. Let's say that the assertion is true that U.S. airports really have fallen behind other airports around the world. What difference does it make? Is it really that big a deal to not be the best in the world when it comes to airports? What do you guys think?
It's not the biggest deal in the world to me, but it just sends a very negative message to foreigners who are coming over to the U.S. Like at JFK, it's not the best airport in the world. It's not the worst. But when you have the most minor of interruption to flight operations, you have flights like Lufthansa coming in that have to wait 4 hours or more for a gate to unload passengers after an eight-hour flight. And it just sends a very negative message to people coming over to the U.S. that this is their first experience. And this cramped corridor is your first experience. And this four-hour wait for a gate and a three-hour wait at customs, this is your first impression of the United States. And it doesn't send a good message.
Mm. No, and I agree. I think that's, you know, an airport is often these days the gateway to a city. In the old days, maybe 100 years ago, it would have been the train station, but now it's the airport. And it really is a place that a community can make it or break it. And I think that's why so many of these cities do spend as much money on their airports as they do, because they want, as Jason said, they want people to have a good first impression, especially if you're coming from a place that you kind of expect. You go, wow, we're going to America, you know, where the things are incredible and what have you, whether it's true or not. But still, you need to make an impression with people that they'll want to come back, or that, you know, if you want to do business with them or whatever it is. And most of the airports in the U.S. are not real impressive.
But the business case for spending the money, making the investment, isn't it a little bit intangible? I mean, isn't it hard to quantify the value of, you know, spending X billion dollars on a particular airport, and what's the return from that? From that investment?
And besides, the reason why they're old and decrepit is because, as a general rule, we were the first ones to have them. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
The Middle East, they're all shiny and new because they've only built them in the last 15, 20 years. I mean, LaGuardia has been around since the 40s and the 30s. Newark has been around since the 20s.
Okay, but why does anybody ever buy a new house then? You know, why? You could say the same thing about
a house in a long time, Rob.
Yeah, okay, well, all right. But
it really goes back to the key of Biden's speech, though. His overall speech was talking about our crumbling infrastructure. And just because we were the first to have a transcontinental railroad and power infrastructure across the country doesn't mean we should ignore improving it and upgrading it. And remaining stagnant shouldn't be an option.
Yeah, well, you should see some of the military installations that are scattered throughout this country, too. So it all depends upon how you want to look at it. They're constantly spending money at the place that's 2 minutes walk from my house, and they want to put in a third runway. But two-thirds of the neighborhood in the area around here that have their potential of their house being leveled because they want to put in another runway is delaying that runway by quite a few years as we fight all these legal battles. When LaGuardia was built, wasn't around anything. Now it's in the middle of basically an urban infrastructure. So it's a lot of money, and Port Authority has a lot of projects, and World Trade Center is one of them. But had 9/11 not occurred, I still don't think they would be throwing lots of money at LaGuardia.
I mean, that's hard to say. We'll never know for sure, obviously. But even the director of the Port Authority himself said, we've spent so much time on this building, we've basically forgotten about everything else we do. So there's no ignoring the fact that they've basically neglected their airports and everything else that they do. So there definitely is something that we need to do about in this country. We can't just let our infrastructure go to waste.
It needs to be a national priority.
Right.
Recently, there was an article in CNN, World's 14 Best Aviation Museums, and we thought it was kind of an interesting list, and between us, we've visited many of them, not all of them. We thought it would be kind of fun to run through these aviation museums and talk about which ones we've been to. And for those that none of us have been to, maybe some of you listeners have visited these and can let us know your thoughts about those museums. And also, if there are any others that you would put in the top list of best aviation museums that aren't on the CNN list. So why don't we just kind of roll through these, starting with number 14 and moving on up the list. The 14th museum in the CNN list is Palm Springs Air Museum, which is, of course, Palm Springs, California. And David, do I understand that you visited that museum?
Yeah, but it was years ago. The Palm Springs in Chino, I visited when I was a little tiny kid. So, but been there, done that. But I don't know. It clearly has changed if it's made the top 14. It was a lot smaller back in the 70s when I was there.
And I think that's one of the things that the CNN article mentions is that it's a small museum. The managing director is quoted saying they love to bring in temporary exhibits. So it's not a static group of a static fleet of aircraft. They try to change things around. So I think that's kind of cool. Number 13 is the Central Museum of the Air Forces in Menino, Russia. Now, I bet none of you guys have been to that museum.
Nope.
No, but I'm sure that our friend Skippy has been over there and taken lots of pictures, so we'll have to encourage him to send some of those in for us.
Yeah, according to the article, there are a lot of military airplanes there, MiGs, Tu-142 bombers, Tu-22 bombers, and even the Tu-144 supersonic passenger plane, which would be pretty exciting to see. Also, they have over there, apparently, the flight uniform that Francis Gary Powers was wearing when his U-2 spy plane was shot down. I didn't know that was on display.
Well, once they washed it, I mean, it was good as new.
Okay.
and it's ironic that you say that, because this week, and I don't know the year of it, but this week is when we exchanged Powers for the Russian spy to return him to the United States.
I think it was around 62. I think it was 62 or 63 that happened.
Sounds about right. Wow. All right. Well, number 12 in Australia, in Alice Springs, Australia, is the Royal Flying Doctor Service Museum. And I'm sure Grant or Steve or somebody over there, one of the guys from Plane Crazy, have been to that. It has a theater.
Don't know about that. Alice Springs is pretty much in the middle of nowhere.
Is it?
I was sort of surprised that they chose this, whereas they have the Royal Air Force, Royal Australian Air Force Museum, which is around the corner from Grant and Steve. This is a far cry from Melbourne.
The Flying Doctor Service, according to the article, that was started by founded by a minister in 1928. And I guess, David, the idea was to bring medical services to this kind of outback or this sparsely populated part of the world.
Yeah, and actually they're still in existence. Basically, the doctors became pilots and would fly their aircraft out with medical supplies and randomly check on the and stop in and check on the ranchers. Kind of, you fly in for a week and take care of all the patients and move on to the next town.
All right, very good. Number 11 in the list is Red Bull Hangar 7 in Salzburg, Austria. And, of course, we know which one of our listeners was recently there and did an interview for us, don't we, guys?
Oh, and he went on and on and on, because every time he turned around, there was another hangar. I mean, it sounded like the Air and Space Museum. I mean, I would really like to have seen that, though. It sounded pretty cool.
It does sound cool, yeah. Launchpad Marzari was there, and he had his report back in Airplane Geeks episode 280. So if you want to go back and catch that, that's at airplanegeeks.com/280. Launchpad gave us a great interview from Red Bull Hangar 7. Very exciting. Number 10 on the list, the Canada Aviation and Space Museum. And that's in Ottawa. You know, I've been to Ottawa, and I didn't know that I missed a museum.
Well, it is the capital of Canada, and it seems to be fitting that the official Canadian Air and Space Museum is in Ottawa. Been there, really cool stuff. Like, the Canadian tilt rotor, that as well as not some of the stuff in York, but a lot of Canadian artifacts, and definitely a visit for our northern brethren.
Number nine on the list, and this is another one where I was in town and never knew that there was a museum there, and that's the China Aviation Museum in Beijing.
This is one of the countries that I have to admit, maybe because we have been so cut off from these folks for so long, that I never would have imagined that one of the top 10 aviation museums in the world was in China.
Hmm.
It's the only museum that has a P-61 Black Widow that I haven't seen. Reading has one, the Air Force Museum has one, and the National Air and Space Museum. The only other P-61 Black Widow left in the world actually is in the China Aviation Museum.
Wow.
I wonder how they got it.
It flew out of there in World War II.
Huh.
I understand they have over 200 aircraft at that museum, Chinese fighter jets, and they even have a replica of the Wright Flyer, which is kind of interesting.
Cool.
And it says that this replica, besides that, they also have a plane that was once Chairman Mao's personal transport. So I guess that gets a lot of attention. So that was number nine. Number eight is the Polish Aviation Museum in Krakow, Poland. Now, I'm sure, have any of you guys been there? Probably not.
Nope.
So we'd like to invite any listeners who have been to that museum to just send us a quick note. Tell us about what you liked about it. There are apparently there's many Soviet era Cold War jets displays with memorabilia and quite a collection. So it sounds like an interesting museum if you're in that part of the world. And then number seven, back on my favorites list, is the Pima Air and Space Museum, which is in Arizona. This is, David, have you been to this museum?
I have not. It's on the bucket list because I want to go to what's next to it also. So,
right. It's across the street from the Boneyard, the Aerospace Maintenance and Regeneration Group is what they call, I guess, the area where they have around 4,000 aircraft, I think, that are there.
Sheesh.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. But at the Pima Air and Space Museum across the street from that, they have many aircraft outside. Of course, being there in Arizona, the aircraft they don't really deteriorate very much outside. So they're in pretty interesting conditions. They also have some aircraft inside. But outside, they have an SR-71 that is actually under sort of, I guess I'd call it kind of a canopy sort of a thing. They have a B-29. And just a lot of other aircraft that you just don't see in most places. It's a beautiful place to visit. I personally recommend that one very, very highly.
And it also is, it helps that you're next to the largest aircraft reclamation center in the world, where if you want something, you go across the street and say, we'll tow it and take it off your hands.
Another, they had a B-52 there too. I don't know if it's still there. There's an interesting story. If you can get a hold of one of the older curators there, or older historians, and ask him how that B-52 came to be at the Pima Air and Space Museum at a point in time when arms reductions were causing some B-52s to be chopped up. There's an interesting story there. I'll just leave it at that. There's also some other interesting things to see around that area. I know that we visited an old Nike missile site, and you can actually go down in there. Yeah. In fact, you can actually sit in the seat with the button in front of you, just like folks used to do with their fingers on the button. It's an interesting tour for sure.
The code isn't still 000.
Yeah, I think it's probably more complex than that, I hope.
No, that's the launch code.
Evidently, our launch group, A, cheat on tests, and B, follow Justin Bieber's lead recently in nuclear history.
All right. Number six, we're getting up there now. This is in Kiev in the Ukraine, the State Aviation Museum of Ukraine. If any of our listeners have been there, love to hear your thoughts. They have a Tupolev 104 there. That was they say that's the world's first jetliner, the Tupolev 104. Is that an accurate characterization, David? You know,
I'll take their word for it. I don't think it's right, but who am I to argue against Rob Mark's employer?
Okay. Number five, the French Air and Space Museum, and that's at Le Bourget, obviously in France. Jason, have you seen that museum?
Yeah, I went there the day before the Paris Air Show last year. It's a very cool museum. They have not one but two Concordes, of course, because it's France. They have a Air France 747. They have, I think, six different halls, an entire hall dedicated to these absurd prototype military aircraft, which just scare me even to look at, to consider someone would be in that thing flying it, just blew my mind.
I love that kind of stuff. The ideas that never went too far.
Yeah, in fact, I've been there too, and it's pretty cool when you see a room full of Concords. I mean, they're just all stuck in a big building, and it's pretty cool.
This article says that it's 1.6 million square feet. That with 19,000, almost 20,000 exhibits. That sounds huge.
It is huge, yeah. And, I mean, they have two Concords and a 747. It's got to be huge.
Yeah, for sure.
And they have every model of a Dassault aircraft ever created, at least one version of it. So if you're, besides the 747s and the two Concords, it does have probably the greatest collection of French aircraft ever, up through World War I.
Hmm.
And it is not true that all the French airplanes run on wine. That is not true.
Just the pilots.
No, just champagne.
Just the pilots. That's right.
Number four is the Future of Flight Aviation Center in Boeing Tour. That's in Washington, the state of Washington in the U.S. And that's where the Aviation Geek Fest is going to be held. That's coming up. Let's see. When is
next week?
This weekend.
Yeah.
This weekend, record that. Yeah.
Yeah. Also a very cool place. So I've had a chance to see that one.
Number three. Another favorite, the National Museum of the United States Air Force, which is in Ohio. And David, you and Rob, as well as myself, I think all three of us have been there, not at the same time, but you guys have seen that place, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes, I have, and I'm very happy to hear this week that they made the announcement that they're building the fourth building. So,
oh, are they?
It's growing. So, yeah, the next building will be transport, so there'll be things like C-130s in it, as well as Air Force space flight. So looking forward to going back out to making the pilgrimage every 5 years. It seems like I go out to pay my respects to probably the greatest military aviation collection in the world. However, my favorite collection, you have to go to the other side of the field, which is they have a collection of all of the aircraft that called the President's Collection, which is all the aircraft up through the Boeing 707, the VC-25 that Kennedy flew in, all of the presidential aircraft, one of each, and that's always my favorite collection.
I didn't know that was there as well. It's close by?
It's actually in the museum annex, which is on the other side of the base. You have to get special permission, and last year when I went to Dayton, unfortunately, due to sequester, they had shut it down. There's two large buildings over on the other side of the base where the restoration hangars are. One holds the presidential collection. The other one holds the research and development collection that has things like NX-29, NX-15, the YF-12A, and currently the XB-70 Valkyrie. But that will be moving back to the other side once they build the fourth building.
Yeah, this is definitely a museum that I need to go back to. Maybe this summer sometime we'll do that, for sure. Number two on the list, getting close to the top, is the Imperial War Museum in Duxford. And I know a number of our listeners have been there. And David, you have as well?
I have. I was over there in the late 80s. I spent 6 weeks in Great Britain and Scotland and Wales and the north of France, and basically toured aviation museums and train museums, but we won't talk about the train. But probably the greatest military museum in the world is Duxford. Besides just airplanes, it's for military geeks, it's very, very impressive. And to throw in another, there's the Royal Air Force Museum, and the Royal Army Helicopter Museum, which are two other museums that you can that are well worth seeing in Great Britain.
Hmm, very good. All right, that leaves just number one, and this is, I think, maybe our favorite. Certainly the one that we visit most often. This is the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. And, of course, both David, Rob, and myself have been there for the Become a Pilot Day for the last, what is it, 3 years now? Have we been there three times?
This will be the third time, this one that's coming
this
up.
This will be the fourth time coming up.
Right, like I said, the fourth time.
We did it
sure
once
about
with,
that?
We did
fourth
it once
time,
with
huh?
Dan and twice without him, and this will be number four.
Right. That's what I said, sort of, kind of.
And, of course, the Smithsonian Museum is actually at two different physical locations, right? There's the original Smithsonian Museum down in D.C. itself, and then there is the Uberhazy Center at Dulles, adjacent to Dulles Airport. And the history of that, I guess, David, is that besides the museum downtown, they had, of course, a large collection of planes that they couldn't fit into that facility. And through the generosity of Stephen Udvar-Hazy and his contribution, they were able to build this next to Dulles so they could house this large collection.
And the restoration centers. And one of the things, we talked about this a couple episodes back, where I was down to tour the Restoration Center. It will be 2024 before that hangar is full.
Wow.
They still have lots and lots of open space, and they're planning to build out even more and more. It's kind of amazing, the thought of more aircraft in that museum. But their biggest announcement was that the next two big airplanes to show up at the Udvar-Hazy Center will be a B-17 and a B-26.
Mm.
So they also own a C-130, and there's a lot of sizable aircraft that aren't on display yet. And if you think about it, the Smithsonian's collection, I think they made the announcement, or we talked about it, was 1/10 or 1/15 of their total collection is on display.
It's just incredible.
That includes artifacts as well as aircraft. So
yeah.
It is, we are blessed that I am very happy that I'm only 3 hours away, and it's a day trip to go to Mecca, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Though, no one will argue that I will drive 8 hours to go to Dayton too. So,
well, it's probably worth mentioning again that each year at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum out at Dulles, we have a flocking of the airplane geeks, if you will, for the Become a Pilot Day Saturday, which is always Father's Day, and we'll be there again this year. And so we want to invite...
June 14th.
Just be flocking around either.
I'm not sure. We never know what we'll be doing. One thing we often do is, I guess we always have done, is Saturday evening after the event, sort of congregate at one of the local restaurants, watering holes, and having a dinner and meeting with some of our listeners and friends and so forth. And we probably will do that again. But if you're in the area or can be in the area for that weekend, highly recommend it. It's a great event. It's a great place to bring your kids to and introduce them to the excitement of aviation. And we'll put a link again in the show notes to that events page. Although I think last time I checked, the information they had up there was from last year's, the 2013 event. So they haven't updated to 2014, but it's still valid, and will give you an idea of what the event's like.
However, the application is up if you want to fly your airplane in, and that's one of the interesting things about Be a Pilot Day is people bring their airplanes to display, and you get to land at Dulles International Airport in between the A380s. And then you get to taxi across the field and through the gates, and you're on the property of the National Air and Space Museum. So if anyone's doing that this year and wants some ballast, I'll be happy to drive wherever and volunteer.
Rob, you should fly in there yourself.
I don't have an airplane to bring. I guess if I brought somebody from the flying club.
Yeah,
it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, maybe I have to think about that. All right, well, that's the top 14 aviation museums, as collected by CNN. If you have some that aren't on the list that you'd like to toss in, to consider, to do that. I'll have a list of all these in the show notes, probably links to each of the museum web pages as well. Jason, you keep a pretty good ear on the ground when it comes, or maybe in the air when it comes to air travel these days. One of the things that always seems to come up when we talk about technology and what's going on, what's happening, and so forth, is Google, one way or another. And I know you've written for the Runway Girl Network on Google and travel and some of the effects. And you recently you saw something about Virgin Atlantic and Google Glass.
Yeah, I saw this today about Virgin Atlantic trialing Google Glass, which is this augmented reality thing you wear basically over your eye. And the details are still really sketchy, where the people who would check you in at the club, if you're flying upper class out of Heathrow, somehow Google Glass would know who they're interacting with so they could check you in faster, allegedly, and have flight information readily available. I'm not too sure on the specifics of how it works, but it's definitely a very interesting trial to keep our eyes on.
We really do see a lot of technology being introduced into the travel experience in lots of different ways. Some of them make a lot of sense to me, as sort of basic tools that an air traveler would find useful. Sometimes you see things and you say, well, maybe that's just sort of, you know, done for publicity or to draw attention to the airline or whatever. And it's not, maybe doesn't add as much value as you might think. I don't know. What do you think this is with Google Glass? I think this is just Virgin Atlantic being hip and with it.
I think you hit the nail on the head that this is more of a vanity kind of thing. Like, hey, look at us. We're cool. We have a thing on our eye that can tell who you are when you walk in the building. I don't think there's a practical use for this at this point, but Google is all-seeing, all-knowing, it seems. So where they go from here is anybody's guess.
And it's kind of fun to contemplate.
Augmented reality, they call that, huh?
Yeah.
Along those lines, yeah. I mean, you could do augmented reality with your phone where you hold the camera lens up and it shows you a picture of what you're pointing it at and it overlays things in front of it. So if you're walking around with Google Glass, you're supposed to be able to see pertinent information about where you are, or if you want to send a message without having to, I don't know, take your phone out of your pocket, you could do that. I think it's something that's going to be very interesting in the future, but right now it just seems very not quite there yet.
See, I see David jumping into something like that, saying, of course, and if you want to know where you are, you could just look up at the street sign.
Oh, unless you're covered in snow.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
But then again, Google is doing some very interesting things besides just Google Glass. They know everything. When you get an email confirmation to your Gmail account from travel, be it from an airline or a hotel, they crawl through your data and they know that. So recently I had 3 flights in one day, and all 3 of these flights were laid out on the home screen on my phone with the flight status of every flight that was coming up. And they were able to get the flight status information to me and delay notifications to my phone before even the airline at the airport or through their own app was able to. So what they know at times is at a higher level of detail than even the airline knows.
Yeah, and that's an example of what I was thinking when I talked about tools that really do add significant value to the air traveler. That kind of stuff is great. I mean, just think back to the old days. Remember when we used to travel and you didn't know what was going on, and when something it became apparent that something was going on, how much difficulty there was to try to get the information and decide what to do next. Now it's pretty painless.
I wouldn't know how to travel without a mobile phone at this point, because the biggest issues that we used to deal with, flight cancellation, flight delays, it's almost like a no big deal under some circumstances now, where if I have a delay over 20 minutes or if my flight gets canceled, I get a push notification on my phone. It says, here are your options. Here's what we can do for you. Click, 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 and you're rebooked in 30 seconds. And this used to take hours potentially just a couple years ago.
And even if you're not proficient with that kind of technology, there's services like Cranky Concierge that, you know, they can use those tools to stay on top of things and then quickly communicate to you the things that you need to know. So it's really a different kind of a world for the traveler.
It's really a big point of change right now where the information's out there and firms like Google are just finally starting to embrace this data and do something with it properly, to the point where not only do they know what we're doing, but they can leverage it in a way that we could also use what they already know about us. If it sounds kind of circular, but this data has been out there for a long time, but now we're just finally seeing a consumer end use for it.
And is this some of the kind of thing that you're doing with Route Happy these days, with the data that they have?
Yeah. What I've been doing at Route Happy for about the last month is I've been helping them aggregate data about different airlines, be it their in-flight entertainment or Wi-Fi or seat pitch and width, and if it's a 777-300 with 9 abreast seating or 10 abreast seating. And what they do is compile that all on their website and they give it a score, be it 1 through 10. The higher the score, the higher the rating for that particular flight. So you're not only searching by price like you would see on most flight search sites, but you're also getting a tangible number that will tell you for $5 more, you can be this much more happy on this particular flight because of Wi-Fi or 3 inches additional pitch. So this information was just, it's all out there. It's just sourcing it all and putting it together in a way that people can actually use and understand.
So are there other things going on in the air travel industry that are of interest to you or things that you may be writing about in the future?
I've been following, like we mentioned before, a lot about the redevelopment of the airports in New York. All three airports are getting at least a minor to major overhaul. Let's see. I've also been focusing a lot on expansion of JetBlue at certain airports like Boston. They've grown exponentially. And coming up, I'm going to be writing a piece about JetBlue in Fort Lauderdale, where their target is to have 100 flights per day. And they've really invaded these markets that no one else has been able to succeed at before. And it's been an interesting series, and I'm looking forward to expanding on it.
Somehow they've found the magic to make it work.
Yeah, basically. In Boston, JetBlue, as I'm sure you know, is really a leisure traveler airline. They don't have a business class cabin, technically not yet. They don't really have a mileage-based rewards program. But in Boston, they've found that the method that's worked for them the best is marketing towards business customers and corporate customers. And this is something they really don't focus on much of anywhere else. And it's been really interesting to dig into that and see what they've been up to and what's working in some cities and not elsewhere.
But they also don't have a lot of Wi-Fi on their airplanes yet, do they?
I was on their the journalist test flight of their new Wi-Fi system called FlyFi. And it is on, I think, 10 or 12 planes now out of several hundred. So a very small percentage of the fleet has it, but it is a very impressive system. And I'm looking forward to getting to the point where you can predict having it on a JetBlue flight and just knowing it's there. It's a remarkable system.
Mary Kirby was on that flight as well, wasn't she?
She was. Seth Miller, John Walton, Cynthia Drescher, basically everyone I know from the passenger experience front of the airline industry was on that flight.
Did we get invited to that, Max?
Not this time, no.
Oh.
Maybe next time.
Next time.
I'm going to fly JetBlue on Wednesday. They're taking, that's what's, it's our vacation airplane, so we'll see.
Good. Maybe you can ask them if they can, include us next time when they have a press flight.
Right. I'll talk to them about that.
Okay, good. All right, Jason, thanks so much for joining us. Are you able to stick around for a while?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, good.
If you like our podcast, you'll also like NBAA's Flight Plan, Business Aviation News from the Source. Pete Combs, what's coming up on the February 17th program?
Thanks, guys. FAA streamlines the approval process for installing angle of attack indicators in GA aircraft. Now, a push to learn how to use them.
pilot not trained to understand its indications, it becomes just another needle flopping around and doesn't really mean much.
You'll find NBAA's Flight Plan podcast on iTunes and at our website, nbaa.org.
Well, then, with that, let's move on to our history segment, and we'll ask David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, to give us something entertaining and enlightening.
Oh, I like the way how that sound.
I hope you can live up to it. The intro.
Probably not, but I'll muddle my way through. Folks, as you know, I reserve the right to write what I want, and it's my segment, and I'll write what I want. So, I was not interested in history today, so I wrote something else. Susie and Pilot Alex's first love. It was a cold winter, a very cold winter. The winter since December was bleak, gray, and ugly. Susie was to the point of just hoping for some circuits and bumps. It was that bad. A plane should not be stuck in a hangar, she said out loud. I heard that. At least you have a hangar. All I have is these cold, wet tarps, said Cecily, the Cessna 172, from the flight school next door. Sorry, Susie piped back. At least you've gone for a flight. Pilot Rob hasn't taken me flying since the beginning of January. It's now February, and how am I going to be prepared to fly to Oshkosh if I don't ever fly? Just then, Pilot Rob walked in. Hello, old girl. Susie never liked that. She was not old. She was born in 2010. Missed me, he chirped. Guess what? Susie's pistons jumped with delight. Could it be? Yes, yes. Believe it or not, we're going on a flight, said Pilot Rob. The hangar doors were open to the gray skies and low-hanging clouds. Susie thought, yuck, and spit out some oil. Pilot Rob was in shock. Susie, that's not very nice. Oh, all right. I'm going flying. Not very high flying, but I am out of the hangar for a while. Just then, another human walked in, shook hands with Pilot Rob. Then the man helped Rob push Susie out onto the tarmac. Pilot Rob walked the man around Susie. It always tickled when he pre-flighted her, as he moved her control surfaces and checked her readiness to fly. They climbed in and put on their headsets. Susie sighed. Oh, another student, this is going to hurt. They always made her landing gear hurt because they were always so hard on their landings. If I'm lucky, this is his first flight and Pilot Rob will do all the hard stuff. Then she realized Pilot Rob was sitting in the right seat. Uh-oh. Okay, Alex, let's get this check ride started, called Pilot Rob on the radio. Susie started her engine, and away they went down the taxiway. Not much had changed, though she did see that Steve, the C-130E, was in the process of an engine change. Wonder what was wrong there, she thought. As she taxied, she realized Mr. Alex was really light on the brakes. This is different. Just then, Pilot Rob came on the radio. So how does she taxi? Anything like your Viper? Mr. Alex replied, I'll let you know when we get to the last chance point. Oh, wait, I'm not carrying any weapons, huh? They both laughed. Susie thought, I wonder what this Viper is. They reached the runway. November 521 Sierra Zulu requesting takeoff on 25 called Mr. Alex. Good old Ben the Tower gave her clearance. 21 Sierra Zulu cleared for takeoff. And away they went down the runway. Ah, cooed Susie. It felt so good to feel the rush of the wing over her wings. She was again home. I hate hangars. Then she remembered poor Cecily outside in the cold. Okay, I dislike hangars. In the cockpit, Pilot Rob and Mr. Alex were talking, and it seemed like a check ride. They talked about something called openairplane.com. Pilot Rob said that Pilot Rod and Pilot Adam were working very hard to make airplanes feel special and get used more. Susie liked the sound of that. She also liked that they were pilot people and not these students who made her hurt. So then Susie heard Pilot Rob say, so you engage the autopilot, you hit this. Woohoo! Shouted Susie. She was going to fly herself. Yay! Suddenly she felt so good. She was a happy airplane. Pilot Rob quietly said to her, keep her level, old girl. I'm not old, retorted Susie. I'll forgive you this time. You are letting me fly. About 10 minutes later, she heard Pilot Rob say, well, if the air is smooth, that should give you enough time to get it done. How about we head home? Mr. Alex agreed and turned off the autopilot, and they returned for home. Sad that she wasn't flying anymore, she realized Mr. Alex was a good pilot. He evidently flew over strange places like Iraq and Korea. As they got closer to the airport, Susie realized that this was really foggy. She hated ILS. She once thought she heard Pilot Rob say is, "I'm lost, shucks," or something like that. Mr. Alex was cool, and before she knew it, she was on rollout on runway 7. That's good. A quick taxi back to the hangar. I'm cold. He's good, thought Susie. Okay, he's no longer a mister. He's Pilot Alex, she thought. Well, check right done. You're cleared to operate, the old girl quipped Pilot Rob as he shook Pilot Alex's hand. Fantastic. I can't wait for Friday. It's going to be a great night. Well, I hope she is pleased, said Pilot Rob. Now, Susie, you be a good old girl for Alex. Old girl, I'm 4 years old. Ooh, that makes me mad. 2 days later, the hangar opened up again, and there was Pilot Alex with another human. Oh no, not more bumps and circuits, thought Susie. Shannon, this is Susie. She's an SR-22, and I'm taking you flying to watch the sunset over the city. I know you're always on the ground when I'm away, and you keep me grounded. So for this Valentine's Day, I want you to know what I see when I fly. Miss Shannon said, "Ooh, I don't know about this. Can't we just go to dinner?" Pilot Alex replied, "I promised Susie we'd fly today, and we can't let her down, can we?" "Oh, all right," said Miss Shannon. Pilot Alex pushed her out of the hangar. Wow, the sky was blue and starting to be on fire. Wonder what Valentine's Day means, thought Susie. This is going to be fun, though. I haven't been up at night in a long time. Pilot Alex helped Miss Shannon into her seat. Susie wished she would stop squirming. It was screwing up her balance. Pilot Alex taxied her out on the runway 7, and with Ben saying 2-1 Sierra Zulu cleared for takeoff, Susie ran down the runway and up she went. What a night. Why doesn't Pilot Rob do this for me more often? As they climbed, the sun started setting on the city and it glistened off in the distance. The sky started turning all sorts of colors. Pilot Alex asked, "So what do you think? This is the closest thing I could find to my F-16. Lots of glass. You can see everywhere." Miss Shannon said, "Wow, this is gorgeous." Then Pilot Alex said, "Can you hold the yoke for a moment?" "Oh, no," said Miss Shannon. Pilot Alex said, "Oh, come on, I need your help and this is easy." "Well, okay," replied Miss Shannon, and she grabbed the stick. Pilot Alex then turned on the autopilot. Susie was flying herself. She was high in the blue-black sky. She listened as the radio crackled. Pilot Alex took Miss Shannon off the stick and keyed his mic. "Shannon, I'm away so much, yet you are always there when I come home. While this is my first love, I have found one that surpasses that. Will you marry me?" Susie didn't know what marry meant, but she was happy she could keep herself level for Pilot Alex, because this seemed important. And as the sun disappeared into the ground, Miss Shannon said, "Yes, yes, I will marry you. And then you're going to teach me how to fly." Both Pilot Alex and Miss Shannon laughed. Pilot Alex turned off the autopilot, and Susie flew west into the stars, thinking, "It's been a good day." So, for Susie the SR-22, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Oh, thanks, David. Boy, there's a lot of references in there that some of them are subtle, some of them are pretty obvious, but very good. Nice job.
The only comment I have is that even I knew I wouldn't call her old. Just my only thought. I loved it.
All right. Makes it,
okay.
Well, maybe it's because we tend to call other people old.
Well, not too many people are a lot older than me, so you know how that
goes. No, that's true. Well, we do have two folks that we know who are definitely not older than you, Rob, and of course that's Stephen Grant.
Yeah, but I'm in better shape than they are this week, I'll tell you that.
That may very well be.
You know, when are we going to – we have to mention, of course, that Steve's coming back from a long rehab there with his knee. And
yeah.
Something wait, so what happened? Grant did something this weekend. What was it again?
Did he?
He got a 2-year subscription to dating. Oh, no, wait a minute. Oh, no, he actually.
No, that was Dan.
Well, that means Dan is the only person that's part of this crew that's still single.
Yeah, because Grant tied the knot.
All right, Grant. Congratulations.
Congrats.
Yeah.
And Kit, we still don't know what you see in him.
But there must be something. All right. Well, the guys had an interview recently with Matt Hall, and he's talking about his preparations for the upcoming Red Bull Air Race season. So let's listen to Steve and Grant.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 9th of February, 2014. Oh, I can't do this, mate. I'm too busy celebrating. I just got married.
Absolutely, you did. Congratulations in advance, Grant. Who would think we're recording this in advance anyway?
Oh, we'd never do that. No,
of course not. Welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 286. Now, Grant, seeing as you and I are busy this week away near Canberra celebrating your recently held nuptials, I don't think we can do a proper segment this week. So instead, we're going to play a snippet of an interview we recorded with Australia's Red Bull Air Race pilot, Matt Hall, which we recorded earlier in the week. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, guys. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, yes. Matt, now how many times have we bumped into you over the intervening years between Red Bull Air Race seasons and saying, you know, is it coming back? Is it coming back? Well, finally, it's back. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a number of times, and it's actually good that it's back because I was about to get a tattoo on my forehead that says, I don't know. Asked that many times. Now it's all happening, and I've got something to concentrate on again.
That's fantastic. Now, it kicks off on the 28th of February, and a slightly shorter race season, it seems. I think there's only 8 races in this season. It seems to me perhaps a proof or maybe a reproof of concept for the air race.
Possibly. Funnily enough, it's actually a bigger season than I've ever raced in. Yeah, the 2 years that I was in it, I think they both started off as 9 race seasons, but in the end, there were only 6 races held. So if they actually get all the races up and running, it's one of the biggest seasons they've actually completed, which is one of the things they were aiming at, was getting some security that when someone signed up for a race, they're going to have the race, rather than last time people would get a lot of appetizers and there's going to be a race on them pull out at the last moment.
Yeah, I guess there's been a lot of talk here from people that are the fans of the race and obviously disappointed that it's not coming back to Australia this time. But I guess my hope personally is that, if it really proves a success in 2014, then it might create a bit of an impetus for an expansion and maybe it will come back here to Australia.
Oh, yeah. I think the intent is that, there's no doubt the intent is that the race is coming back and it's coming back to stay. There's always a risk in anything as a restart, but they've put a lot of effort into making this thing be bigger and better and faster than it was last time. And they're signing up, basically everything that gets signed up at the moment gets signed up on a 3-year deal. So they're effectively saying we've got 3 years to get this happening, so it's a self-sustaining model, and Australia is part of that 3-year plan. So I'm reasonably confident that there's going to be something in Australia in the not-too-distant future.
Well, that's excellent. Now, of course, we know that that you've been very busy doing, the air show and the promotional work and everything else. Do you keep in much contact with people like Hannah Sark and Peter Besenier and all those people? I notice here on the Red Bull Air Race website that it's the same lineup as the last season, pretty much. Do you keep in contact with those guys?
Yeah, we've stayed in contact quite a bit. Some guys more than others. Yeah, I caught up with them all. It was last June, I think it was, when I was over in Slovenia racing. Basically trialing all the new systems, and all the old race pilots were there, and I stay in touch. With certain race pilots, I'm almost in daily contact with, and have been daily contact with since it all stopped. So we're a reasonably tight bunch of guys. You end up finding your favourite 2 or 3 guys that you communicate with more than the others. But we are all on group emails and share our thoughts, and already share a little bit of competition trivia and slamming each other. So it's already on, that's for sure.
Now, Matt, you mentioned you were in Slovenia in June last year. Was that the first of the workup sessions? How have you gone for getting back into the swing to be ready for racing?
Yeah, you're right. That was the first training session. They had 2 training sessions. The first one was mainly to get all of the previous race pilots back up to speed and address all of the new stuff and look at new pylons and new rules and get all of our opinions. And that that flying session went pretty well. They just used European-based aircraft, so I flew Nigel Lamb's MXS. And it was one of those things that you sort of wonder, have I forgotten how to race? And I was actually the first guy down the chute on the first day we flew in the track. And yeah, I briefed myself, hey, I'll just take it casual. I've got 5 minutes in the track. I'll just take it pretty casual and fly above the pylons. I did one lap above the pylons. Yeah, when I say above the pylons, I'm probably between 1 and 2 feet above them. So but we're measuring pretty closely at that point. And then it's like I'm pretty happy. So then I flew around the next lap. Around the top of the coloured bit, and there's like, yeah, I'm ready. So the final lap of that first 5 minute training session, I flew it as a racetrack right down in the guts of the high band, and it felt really nice to be back in it.
And have there been many other sessions since then?
They had one more session, which they held after the World Aerobatic Championships over in the US. But that session was for the challenges that they're bringing in a new class, which is basically a rookie cup, for another word for it. And that was really just getting all those guys up to speed for a second run through, plus a couple of new guys. And also it was for Pete McLeod to regain his qualification as a race pilot, because in the first one he'd just broken his leg in a skydiving mishap. So
ow.
First time back in the track. So there's only been the two training sessions. We've obviously been doing a lot of training back home here in Australia, and we've got one more training session in the lead up to the Abu Dhabi race, where we'll be training in the UAE in a bit of a private training track, where all the pilots and our race gear and all of the telemetry and cameras and full dress rehearsal with media and everything, like internal media, but it won't be broadcast or publicised what we're doing there. And we'll do that for 5 days before we then fly into the racetrack at Abu Dhabi to race.
Okay, so how have you been training back here in Australia? Have you got pylons you've set up, or are you using trees at home or anything like that? I mean,
it's training is comes in a lot of aspects. So there's there's physical and mental training. So obviously, back in the gym, doing probably 2 to 3 hours a day at the moment, so I'm generally quite fatigued. There's the mental training that, I'm back having regular contact with my sports psychologist and working through routines and disciplines to make sure that, I'm happy with where I'm at. Then there's the training with the team, just making sure that, everything from, the bookkeeping through to, how I get strapped into the cockpit is all good. And then obviously the final part of the training is actually me being in the plane and practicing racing. And for that side of things, I've obviously maintained my currency in the aircraft and, we're using the MXS, which I've been displaying around Australia for the last number of years. So I'm pretty comfortable in that plane now. And what we did is we just set up a basic racetrack that I designed myself just south of Maitland Airfield in a low-flying area there. And it was not around trees, but it was above certain geographical points that were quite obvious to me that I could recognize very quickly without having to look for them.
Okay. So
effectively flying around at 100 feet. And then we actually debriefed that using our telemetry system to have something to aim at. So I was actually improving my times in the track, and then the team, I'd get back and do a full turnaround, be airborne again, somewhere between 12 and 20 minutes later to go out and fly the same track again. So we've done full dressed rehearsals of racing here in Australia for the first time ever. So that was a pretty cool thing to do.
And of course, one more question I should ask you, it's just you and me and Grant talking. I mean, you've got any secrets you're going to tell us about how you're going to take the Red Bull Air Race by storm and win every race?
Oh, since no one else is listening now, I can tell you about the jet engines.
Oh, cool, no worries. Well, there we go, Grant. And, of course, we can already predict in advance that Matt Hall is going to take all the honours. He already had them worried at the end of the last Red Bull Air Race season several years ago. But I'm sure he's going to go in and, take the world by storm this time, and no skipping across the water this time like he did in Canada.
Yeah. Save the walking on water for other people. It's time to focus and fly and not look into the turn. That was what he said went wrong last time.
It's fantastic that the Red Bull Air Race has come back. As time went on and on, we were just thinking it was never going to come back. But I'm really happy to see that it has. Very much a proof of concept. I think there's not so many races going on this year. There are two in the United States, one at Fort Worth and one at Las Vegas, and we are hoping to get over to Las Vegas this year, fingers and toes and everything else crossed, to cover it this year. So that'll probably be the next PCDU overseas trip. You'd better start saving, pal.
Oh, mate, just cost me everything I had to come and do this.
Well, there you go.
Get married.
All right.
Wait a minute.
Well, you've got 6 months to get all your money back.
Let's talk about my day job, mate. Anyhow.
Yeah, let's not talk about that. Let's just make sure sure that our listeners get over and check out redbullairrace.com and, you know, get out there and back Matt Hall. Even if you don't come from Australia, you should back Matt Hall because, you know, he's a friend of ours.
Yeah, he's
great
cool.
guy.
Definitely.
Absolutely. All right, that's everything we have for you this week, and we'll be back next week, Grant, assuming that you're back from your honeymoon. Where are you going for your honeymoon, by the way?
Oh, the honeymoon's not till later because the best time to go to a Pacific island is between July and August, mate.
Oh, no problem. All right, well, okay, no problem. Some people have a tough life.
Yeah, well, you know, that's why Las Vegas could be tricky.
details. Until next week. Cheers, folks.
See you later.
All right. Now, that's actually an excerpt from a longer interview, which will be coming out in episode 116 over at plaincrazydownunder.com. So if you want to hear the full interview, let's look for that. We should also mention that there are a couple, actually two races scheduled for here in the U.S. under the Red Bull Championship, both in, let's see, Fort Worth in September and Las Vegas in October. And anyone who's been to any of the Red Bull Air races will confirm that these are really exciting events, something to not to miss if you're able to attend. And again, congratulations on the wedding, Grant, and have fun on the honeymoon.
I love that Red Bull Air race. I was so disappointed when they held it in New York and I was out of town because something like that probably won't ever come back. And I'm still disappointed to this day that I missed that.
Yeah, that's it's really exciting stuff. I haven't seen it myself either, but that's worth a trip. And maybe next year, maybe the number of races will increase based on the success of this year's races. So hopefully that we'll see that. Okay, now it's time for Peter Johnson, Across the Pond.
Today, I'm joined by Christoph Kuska, Editor-in-Chief of InfoLotNiche, the leading news-related web in the Polish aviation market. Christoph, welcome back across the pond.
Hello, nice to see you here again.
It's fantastic to have you back on the show. Very excited about learning more about Polish aviation. When we talked last time, we talked about the new trainer contract for the Polish military. We know that BAE and some others were involved in that contract, but Poland's made a decision.
Well, they have chosen the Italian Master aircraft, and well, it's not a certain thing right now because they have the Italians have won the first stage.
Oh, okay. Now, I thought that they'd made a decision and that was it.
No. The Italians have won the first stage, and now the aircraft has landed in Poland on the 3rd of February, and this is the second stage.
Right,
they are going to run some tests, and if the tests will be okay, then we can say that this is the final decision. So it's not 100% yet, but they are close.
Yeah, and the M346 seemed to be, in comparison to the other aircraft in the mix, to be a lot cheaper.
Well, this is how tenders in Poland work. In most cases, the cheapest offer wins. And to be honest with you, I don't think that buying M346 is the best possible choice for Poland.
Right,
As you know, we have the F-16, so a natural choice would be to buy the T-50 from South Korea.
Yeah.
They have decided to buy the M-346. And the most interesting thing for me is that I cannot imagine that Poland would buy aircraft from Russia.
Right.
For obvious reasons. And if you look at M-346 and if you look at Yakovlev 130, they're just the same aircraft. But M-346 is built in Italy. It's some kind of a license. I talked about it with my friend who's an aviation expert.
Yeah.
And he doesn't think that Russia would let all the software connected with the aircraft to Alenia. So we're in such a strange situation that a Polish aircraft could have some software blobs inside, and we do not know how this will work in future. So this is a strange situation for me.
Yeah, that's a very odd deal. I've got to be honest, I didn't notice the link with the 130.
And I looked at the photos.
Yeah.
They're very similar.
Yeah, okay, we'll do that. This deal also involves simulators as well. And given what you were just saying about software, this is going to be quite a tricky situation for the Polish military.
Well, I do not know how they will solve it. And, well, I still hope that they won't choose it, that they will decide to pick another aircraft, because the whole process is strange for me. And I really hope that this won't be only a trainer aircraft, that this will be also a fighter trainer, which we can use instead of our aging Su-22s. But nothing came out of it.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's move over into the civilian sector. LOT, the Polish airline, as I always remember her as, they looking for investors. And one name that's been mentioned is Warsaw Airport.
Well, there wouldn't be a merger of those two companies, something more like a holding. But yesterday I was hearing, I turned on my radio and Mr. Mikosz from LOT was talking about this thing. It's not certain. LOT is trying to generate cash flow and to restructure from inside, showing the future probable business partners that it's starting to work well. It still didn't get the second batch of money from Polish government, so it starts to look better. On the other hand, the European Commission asks questions, and you probably know that they ask hard questions.
Yes.
And then they want clear answers. So LOT has to clearly show that everything was correct with taking the money from Poland.
Yeah, and there are some other interested airlines looking to invest. We've talked recently on the show about Etihad and their growth plans, but one that really surprised me was Turkish Airlines looking to is interested in a stake in LOT.
Well, maybe they could buy some part of LOT, but I don't think so. Turkish Airlines, for me, it's a great working airline, and LOT isn't a great offer, if I look at it more broadly. So this could be a risky move for them, and as I'm looking at commercials in Poland, Turkish Airlines put a lot of them. So they're going into the market, but with their own brand.
Okay, and of course, Etihad would be a very interesting partner for LOT.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
They buy both big airlines, so this could be an investment. But as I said, this could be hard.
And just sticking with LOT, bless them, but they've really been having problems with their 787s. Last week, a flight to the Dominican Republic was cancelled because of maintenance issues. Then this week, a flight to Toronto was cancelled due to a major restart of the computer system. This isn't the best of luck for LOT with the 787, is it?
Well, as we talked recently, it's not their best shot, but I would say that LOT will handle it, as they managed to push another aircraft or fix the issue quite quickly. But it's a bigger problem for Boeing, as I think that such a massive amount of problems makes airlines start to look at Airbus and their A350. So Boeing has to start thinking how to convince the market to stay with their aircraft.
Yeah, that's true. And I think we're possibly seeing the A350 and the 787 going head-to-head in Singapore. I think next week at the air show, potentially both of them could be there.
Well, Boeing has recently started the faster production of 787, so they are telling us that they've got a lot of aircraft to build and that they are doing their best, but they have to really start flying without issues.
Yeah.
That's my
Well, Christoph, thank you very much for joining us again. Can you just tell us where we can find out about Infolot Niche online?
Yes, check our website, infolotniche.pl. We've got our English section, and we had recently two great interviews with two pilots from America. One was LC-130. And one pilot from a combat unit flying on A-10. So quite a nice read.
Right. Well, we'll put links to those in the show notes. And I'm going to get away and have a look at those stories now. Christoph, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you very much. See you soon.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
And thanks, Peter and Christoph. Very interesting. Just the whole notion of other airlines investing in LOT in Poland is kind of intriguing. Certainly, if Etihad or somebody like that invests, it sends a signal and tells us something about the direction maybe that some of these airlines are going in. I don't know if we'll see that sort of proliferate into other areas or if this is sort of an isolated situation.
Definitely an interesting topic. I mean, Etihad just a couple of weeks ago snatched up this little regional carrier in Europe, Darwin Airlines, and renamed it to Etihad Regional.
Fascinating, so yeah.
Things like this are happening, and an airline like LOT at some point might be the next snatched up by a big carrier like Etihad.
Great. Interesting to think about. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We heard from a couple folks. We heard from Larry, who commented on last episode's conversation with Mike Collins on his around-the-world flight. And Larry says, sorry he was unable to visit Egypt, a fascinating country where I was fortunate to live for 4 years. He says, next time you see Mike, you might want to tell him that the missing Egypt part of the trip may have been a dark cloud, but it definitely had a silver lining. If he had managed to stop in Luxor, he would have seen some remarkable things, but sadly, the pyramids would not have been among them. The pyramids are not near Luxor at all. They are in Giza, which is on the western outskirts of Cairo, a long way to the north of Luxor. So Mike wouldn't have had the disappointment of having his hopes dashed for a tour of the pyramids. Now, Larry says, I was fortunate to have visited those wonders of the world many times. In fact, during my time in Cairo, I was able to fly motor gliders out of Imbaba Airfield in the western outskirts of Cairo. An extended downwind would mean flying a base leg around the Great Pyramid and its two smaller suns. So he says, enjoy the show. Keep up the good work. And I got to say, boy, that in a motor glider or anything else, that would be some flight around the pyramids, I am sure. Rob, have you ever flown around any kind of monument or natural wonder of the world? Anything interesting?
you mean that I can talk about?
Yeah.
You mean like flying under the arch in St. Louis or... no, I've never done anything like that legally. Did actually go through the arch once in a simulator, but that was kind of cool. But that was as close as I got.
All right. Well, good thing. Or we'll talk about any other adventures you might have had offline.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Ryan wrote in, we had been talking about re-engineering done by civil operators. And he says, well, what about the Convair 580? And he asks, was that done by the military or civil operators? I don't know. Are either of you, any of you guys familiar with the Convair 580 re-engining?
No, not the process. No. I mean, I know what the airplane was like after, but I never, no, sorry.
All right. Well, we may have to do some research on that one, I guess, huh?
Ryan, there's a history segment for you. Let us know.
Yeah, very good. All right. Also, we heard from Ray, you know, from time to time, you'll see a photo or an article about someone who has taken an airplane and converted it into a home. But Ray sends in an article that's titled, This Guest House Wouldn't Fly in Most Neighborhoods. But it's not sort of the typical airplane converted to a house. This thing is a combination. It's got the nose cone of a Boeing 737. It's got the tail section of a 727, and then it's got a guest house built from cabin sections of two 707s. So this thing has been put together from, I don't know, a number of different aircraft. I guess this is kind of the ultimate in aircraft recycling.
Is that a pool I see in one of the pictures?
Yes, I think it is.
Yeah, actually, he has a 747 fuselage with a pool inside of it.
Oh, okay.
Now, I think that's cool. I just really think that's very cool.
What really impressed me the most, and most people, I don't know, well, the airline geek one people would know, but the 737, the 727, and the 707 are pretty much compatible as far as the fuselage goes. And that 737 nose looks pretty normal on the fuselage of the 707s with tails of a 727. So I thought that was kind of interesting that they sort of blend together like they're supposed to.
Hmm. And I'm trying to see where this this house is located.
Arizona.
This is in Arizona. Oh, wow.
It's next to Pima. That's where he gets his fuselage.
That's where he gets the parts. Yeah, very good. Yeah, well, that might be another destination spot. Maybe this guy will end up with a parade of airplane geeks driving past his house taking a look. It is kind of interesting. I could get pretty excited about living in some place like this. I guess a climate like Arizona makes it easier to put together something that's actually livable, given the sort of more consistent temperature and climate conditions. Rob, I think one of these things in Chicago, I'm not sure how well this would do in the biting cold and blowing wind and freezing rains of Chicago.
Oh, you're talking about Chicago. I thought you were talking about Minot, North Dakota, South. Wait, Minot is South Dakota. Well, anyway.
It's the same.
Yeah, it's about the same. That's right.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank Jason Rabinowitz for joining us again. Jason, it's always a pleasure. Tell folks where they can find you online.
You can find me at Twitter at Airline Flyer, also on Facebook at Airline Flyer. I write for Aircive, David Parker Brown's AirlineReporter.com. I also dabble on Mary Kirby's Runway Girl Network. And that's about it.
That's great. Yeah, and proving again that you don't have to be female to be part of Mary Kirby's Runway Girl Network. So
apparently not.
But we are a minority, I think, in terms of the articles. Although I'm not sure of the statistics, but Mary certainly assembled a fantastic group of writers and journalists and folks who love aviation over there. So good for you, Jason, for also contributing there.
Absolutely. I love what she's doing with the new network.
It really is fantastic, isn't it? All right. Well, we'd like to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And Peter Johnson. Find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, people can find me at jetwine.com and jetwine on Twitter and various and sundry places on Facebook. And I just wanted to make a very quick shout out to a loyal Airplane Geeks listener who just happened to be in Chicago this weekend. Mike Swiatek, who's a friend of, I don't know, this guy Dan Webbage or something. he said he knew him, but he made a very interesting point when we were having a beer the other day about our Mike Collins segment. He said, you know what? You guys never actually mentioned the route that they took, a sort of city by city or country by country. And I thought, you know what? That's a good point. He said, well, my guess is they probably went boomity, 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 boom. And he ran through about 20 cities. And I went back up and looked at the route when I got back after I left him. I said, holy smokes, he got almost every one of them right.
Did he really?
Well, he's a route planning guy. He's a route planning guy like Dan. It was almost like sitting with an older version of Dan Webbage. So I just wanted to say thank you for checking out the Airplane Geeks, and it was nice meeting another listener this weekend.
Fantastic. All right, David Vanderhoof, where can folks find you online?
You can find me on Twitter as DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Facebook page, our Google Plus page, various sundry airport pages, and of course on Fridays on the UAV Digest.
Very good. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, as David mentions, at theuavdigest.com for the podcast David and I do. Also with Mary Kirby at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the PaxX podcast that I co-host with Mary. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links to all the sites that we mentioned, some other resources associated with the topics that we discuss. You can use the shortcut to go directly to the post by putting in there airplanegeeks.com/286. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, the usual places, our Google Plus community. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. And you can also find us on TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us a brief audio message. Our Aunt Benet, the aviation queen, has something to say about that.
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
You